Hey friends, let's take a moment and thank our sponsors because they make this podcast possible. Let's talk about a new sponsor, Revelo. Having a hard time hiring engineers? Revelo lets you sidestep the competitive U.S. talent market by helping you find and hire skilled remote engineers in Latin America. They only provide full-time senior engineers with over 5 years of experience, and they don't force you to pay for things you don't need, like a project manager. They charge a monthly fee, and you know exactly how much you're paying the engineers. They do the sourcing, they do the vetting, and you can interview the engineers before deciding. They'll manage all the paperwork, including benefits, payroll, and local compliance. And the time zone alignment is a huge win for U.S.-based teams, and it makes synchronous collaboration easy. Questions are answered quickly and effectively. To learn more, go to revelo.com/Hanselminutes. That's revelo.com/Hanselminutes. And as a special limited-time bonus, you can mention Hanselminutes, and you'll get 20% off the first 3 months. That's revelo.com/Hanselminutes. Hi, I'm Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today, I'm talking with Greg Nasu. He's creating a new operating system for the Commodore 64. You can check it out at c64os.com. How are you, sir?
I'm doing really good. How are you?
I'm having a lovely nostalgic week of Commodore, and I'm just getting steeped in the Commodore of it all, the nostalgia of it all. And I went out there and started buying replacement power supplies and, you know, add-ons and extensions. And I immediately came upon c64os.com, and I went to your buyer's guide, and it is just amazing. You've got like over 450 products and kits and reviews and things from 100 different creators. Did that come first? Did you make the buyer's guide before you made the operating system?
Yeah. Well, I came back after my own little hiatus of a number of years. So I came back in 2016, and all my old hardware I still had, but I didn't have a good way to get data from sort of PC land onto my C64. And I started asking around, well, how do you do this? And people, you know, were giving me suggestions. And I started to uncover this huge world of all these crazy hardware expansions that had come out while I was away. And I realized that they existed, but, you know, it was hard for me to find them. And so I thought, if it's hard for me to find them, I should start making like a list of them to make it easier for new people who are coming back. And then I thought at first, well, maybe there'll be like, you know, 25 products or something, you know, 30 products maybe. And it just ballooned. Like the more I dug in, the more I searched, the more I found. And eventually there were like 200 products, and then there were 400 products. And now there's over 400. So yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, I just replaced my power supply on my Commodore 64, and I thought it was like, oh, there's one. No, there's like 9 options in the power supply space, and they all have their reasons to exist. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to use an SD card instead of a 1541 disk drive. There's an option. No, there's like 20 different ways to do this, and they're all really cool and different in their own way.
Yeah. Yeah, so I was, as soon as I started, I really came back on the idea that I should write an operating system. And so, but I didn't really know what I was doing, and I was very uncomfortable 6502 programming. So I was kind of teaching myself to program 6502 while kind of designing an operating system at the same time. And then while I was doing that, I just started building the website, and I was blogging, and I was building the buyer's guide at the same time. And so everything was kind of happening at the same time. But the operating system was like in very, very early stages when I started the other blog and buyer's guide.
That's cool. So let's bring some of our friends who may be a little bit younger up to speed on the Commodore 64, right? It came out in 1982. It's an 8-bit, 1 megahertz 6510 CPU, which is part of the 6502 family of processors. And it has only 64,000 bytes of directly addressable memory. And when I turn it on, there's this blue screen, that iconic blue screen. Is that an operating system? What is that thing that I'm looking at? It boots up instantly to that screen.
Right. Yeah. I mean, people debate whether that's an operating system, but I think it's an operating system. It is actually referred to as an operating system in some of Commodore's documentation too. But it's not really what modern people think of as an operating system, right? So the thing about the Commodore 64 is that when it was originally sold, it has no internal storage at all. You could buy just the 64 and you wouldn't have any storage. You know, normal computers or modern computers, it's like that's unthinkable, right? It's just, you don't get a computer without storage. So, I mean, I'm not sure how common this was in the 8-bit world, because I only really ever owned Commodores, but there are two ROM chips. One is the kernel ROM, which is 8K, and then the other is the basic ROM, which is 8K. And then I discovered only a couple of years ago that actually basic is a little bit more than 8K, because it uses up a little bit of the bottom of the ROM for the kernel. And Commodore was pretty clever, I think, in the way that they did it. So the kernel is kind of like a low-level operating system, and BASIC is really a completely separate component. Like they're, in fact, I've read some stories that the engineers talking, and they actually decided at a certain point, no, we should really keep these separate, which was a great decision. So BASIC is kind of like the front end. It's like the user interface. And it makes all these calls into the kernel to do all the various low-level stuff that it needs to do.
Okay, so in the modern world, if I have a Linux machine, I boot into Bash or I boot into PowerShell, there's the shell part of things, and that's sitting on top of the kernel, the syscalls that I could make. And then the interpreter for the prompt, the shell there, is separate as well. And this ROM right. chip, this ROM is literally a chip you can point to. That's the thing that's so great about these older machines. You can pop this thing open, you can point to it, and you say, that's the thing, right? The blue stuff is in that chip. And you can swap that out, right? You can replace that with something else, couldn't you?
That's right. Yeah, you can. Yeah. I mean, the other thing that's a little bit different about the Commodore 64's operating system is that it is not a disk operating system. So what that means is that really, like, the kernel doesn't know anything about file systems. It doesn't know anything about file storage. It's more like a communications mechanism for like a small sort of desktop family of interconnected devices. And so if you have no storage device hooked up, the computer doesn't know anything about files. But as soon as you do hook up a storage device, like the classic is like a 1541 disk drive, it's got its own ROM and it's got its own RAM and its own 6502 processor. And when you turn it on, it boots its own operating system on its own processor. And then you connect the two together with a serial cable. And if you're just typing by yourself on the screen, you're issuing basic commands. And there's a basic command to open a connection on the serial bus to a device. And then when you use the print command to send a command over that open connection, the command is being sent directly to the DOS that's running on the device. And it's the device that knows how to interpret that command. Otherwise, the computer has absolutely no idea if that string is meaningful or whatever. What's great about it, though, like what's actually kind of advantageous about that is that nowadays, you know, you can have like a FAT32 file system running on a storage device and the computer has no idea, right? And it's pretty amazing.
Interesting. So like on a Windows machine or a Linux machine, I have to think about, well, do I have a NTFS driver for that? Or do I have an ext4 or a ButterFS driver for that? Because the kernel needs to have these file system drivers. But you're saying when I type load, quote, star, quote, comma, 8, comma, 1, I'm saying to the C64, go on the serial bus and some stuff's going to come at you over there, over that bus. And that's why the 1541 was so expensive. It was another $250. It was a whole other computer in there.
Yeah. I mean, other devices have kind of computers on board too. It's just, it was weird in the 8-bit days because the computer's CPU was so slow that there wasn't a slower CPU to put in the drive, right? It's like the drive CPU and the computer CPU are the same speed. Whereas if you get some kind of, you know, if you get a hard drive now, I mean, the hard drive, technically it has a controller on it, and it's technically running software. Right. It's just that it's so much simpler than the computer's CPU that you don't even think nowadays about the fact that a hard drive actually has a computer built into it.
That is a good definition, because you paused there a little bit, which was kind of like, I hear what you're saying when I was trying to use my analogy there. But what you're saying now is that microcontrollers all the way down and its operating systems all the way down. But in the case of the Commodore, we have this unique situation where they were peers in their speed, and they had ROMs and they had operating systems, except one had a disk operating system.
Yeah, right. So like a 1541's DOS, like the software that's running on a 1541, not only is it driving the motors that drive the head and then mm-hmm. reading the data off the disk with the head, like the software in the 6502 and in the driver doing that, but they're also doing things like the file system and like formatting commands and stuff. So that stuff is also offloaded onto the drive. Whereas on modern computers, it's like normally the drive is just kind of like a block level device. So there's like enough of a microcontroller that you can access blocks. Mm-hmm. And then meanwhile, the computer takes over everything and implements the file system and organizes the data in the blocks.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So then to your point at the beginning there, you said that anything can talk over that serial and just fake it as long as it's talking that serial. It's very quite easy to emulate. So these systems that like a PI 1541 or these, what are they called? SDIECs. They're all just
SD2IEC.
SD2IEC. They're all just phonies that they'll store it wherever you want things to be stored as long as it looks okay on the serial bus.
Yeah, I get, yes. Yeah. Except that the only bone that I would pick is with the word phony, because they're only phony if you come at it with the approach that somehow the 1541 is canonical and these other things are just kind of pretending to be 1541s. But it's that wasn't really even true of Commodore, right? Because they released the 1571 and it was different, but it was still an official drive. And then they released the 1581 and it was official. And, you know, and then CMD, Creative Micro Designs, they released hard drives that also ran on 6502s. And so in my mind, it's like all these drives are legitimate. And it's just the way that the machine was engineered to be able to speak this common, as long as it speaks the common serial protocol.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. Okay. So then in this ROM that you pointed to, I go down the Commodore 64 rabbit hole, I find this thing called Jiffy DOS. What is that? Because that came later, right? And that's a complete replacement, but that's a modern thing, correct?
Well, it's not really modern. I mean, it was made in the 80s. So
it was made in the 80s.
It's pretty retro. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know how deep you want to go into the history, but there were some hardware flaws with the Commodore 64, and Commodore, they solved the problem by just like making the kernel access the disks slower. And they just were like, screw it. And they just put it out. And so like strangely, like a VIC-20 can access a drive faster than a Commodore 64 can. Like there's just weird things like that. And they fixed it later in the Commodore 128.
That's so funny that you mentioned that, because everyone who is following my TikTok adventures here is like, the one thing they remember is waiting for 30 minutes for something to load off of the drive. Like slowness is definitely a memory.
Yeah, but the thing is that once the kernel was baked the way it was baked, it's like Commodore never changed the kernel in the Commodore 64 ever again. It was just they produced it for another decade or more, and they just never changed the kernel.
Okay.
So what Jiffy DOS was, some ingenious guy from the States designed it. It's basically, it's a kernel replacement. So it is you actually pull the original kernel ROM out, you stick the Jiffy DOS kernel in. And like 90% of it is the same as the regular kernel, but it removes support for the cassette drive, which in North America was never really used. It's much more popular in Europe and Britain and stuff. But in North America, I don't know, we had 1541 drives and stuff, so we didn't really use the tape drives over here. So they removed the code that uses the tape drive, and they used the spare space in the ROM to add a bunch of extra features. So there's like a two drive copier, and there's a command wedge, and there's, you know, there's some extra printing stuff, and there's some but then there's mainly the main thing is that the there are much faster routines for communicating over the serial bus. The only other thing though is that you need to upgrade the device with Jiffy DOS as well. But newer devices tend to have that already built in. So like Creative Micro Designs, they sold the CMD hard drive and the FD2000, and they just had Jiffy DOS communications built in. And then the SD2IEC also has that built in. So it's normally like the legacy disk drives that you have to upgrade their ROM chip in order to get them to also speak the Jiffy DOS protocol. I mean, and if the drive doesn't speak the Jiffy DOS protocol, it just falls back on the slow protocol. So,
So does that mean that I would go in 2022 and buy one of these chips, pop open my device, unsocket my existing ROM and pop one of these in, and that's how it upgrades to that operating system?
Yeah, and I like to analogize it to what Amiga users always did with their Amigas and the Kickstart ROM. I don't know if you're an Amiga person, but you know, it was common in my understanding. I've only recently gotten into the Amiga, but in my understanding, it was common for Amiga users to buy a new kernel or buy a new Kickstart ROM rather. And whereas it wasn't really common for Commodore 64 users to do that, but Jiffy DOS feels to me a lot like that. You know, it's like it's got new and better routines and it fixes some bugs and it adds extra stuff and it's backwards compatible. And so you just pop the old ROM out and you stick the new one in.
That's cool. Hey, friends, let's take just a moment and thank our sponsor. This episode of Hansel Minutes is sponsored by Datadog, cloud scale monitoring platform that unifies metrics, logs, and traces from technologies like Istio, AppMesh, and Envoy. Plus, Datadog's service map automatically plots out the dependencies in your microservices architecture for seamless, context-rich troubleshooting. With rich visualizations, algorithmic alerting, and more than 450 vendor-supported integrations, Datadog allows you to monitor your distributed applications in real time. Start a free 14-day trial today by visiting datadoghq.com/Hansel Minutes. That's datadoghq.com/Hansel Minutes. And Datadog will send you a complimentary t-shirt. Bringing us to C64 OS, I'm familiar with, and most of our listeners are familiar with, the blue shell and BASIC. And then we might have a background with GEOS, which would be kind of a windowy kind of a vibe. Some people have heard of it, some people haven't. What will C64 OS do for my Commodore that I have in my garage right now?
Yeah, so it will do a lot of things. It'll do a lot of stuff. It really depends on the sort of the angle you come at your Commodore 64 from. So if the only thing you want to do is play games and your games come on a disc or a cassette, it's not going to do a whole lot for you because, you know, games take over the whole machine and you just stick a disc in the drive and you issue one load command. And then the game basically takes over the entire machine and does its thing. Like a lot of North Americans, like I went to trade shows in the United States and Canada and stuff. And we over here, we always had like stacks of drives and high-speed modems and, you know, digital audio devices and all kinds of cool stuff and memory expansions and so on. The problem is that the operating system that's built in, while it can communicate with those devices, it doesn't really know anything about them and it doesn't really take advantage of them. The other thing is that the basic command prompt doesn't really give you much of a user interface. I mean, besides a textual one, right? Normally people would have to build their own menu system in BASIC if they wanted to do that. But if you wrote your program in assembly, now you're really on your own. Like you have to write your own user interface. And so a lot of software does that. But the problem is that like, you have to write a lot of code to get to the point where you have something usable. And so that takes a lot of time and a lot of effort. And then you also have this problem where you end up with these islands of programs where, you know, maybe you have like a terminal package, but the way that it works is just completely different than, you know, this graphics program that you use and everything's different, right? Like everything is its own little island and they don't exchange data between themselves. And there's very spotty support for modern storage devices with nested subdirectories and stuff. So the main thing that C64OS does is tries to fix all that. Like it brings a unified mouse and menus based interface with an object-oriented user interface toolkit. And it also comes with low-level support for storage devices that have partitions and subdirectories. And then it adds to that dynamic memory allocation and a framework for moving into and out of applications and loading shared libraries, and also for loading a utility concurrently with an application, which normally a Commodore 64 can't do. So when you write an application for C64 OS, you can open any of the utilities that are already existing concurrently with your application. So that allows different applications to share the same utilities. So like you can just offload functionality that you think could be reusable into a utility, and then different applications can open those utilities, and it decreases the amount that you have to program to get something useful done.
Which is like the whole point of an operating system, right? Is to provide services to you that are available. So like if I wanted to write an app right now that used a mouse on a Commodore 64, I'm going to have to do all that low-level work, presumably with, say, 64 OS. You would handle some of that for me. And if I wanted to put a window on the screen and have a scroll bar and a list box, you would help, you know, you would help me with that kind of stuff. And that means that you've offloaded that work, right?
Right.
The interface, when I'm moving around in the C64S, it reminds me of like TurboVision and some of the DOS-based graphical but not graphical. Because are we in a graphics mode or in a text mode when we are using these windows in a C64OS?
We're in a text mode.
It's very convincing. It looks great.
Has it got some graphical flourishes, though, right?
Well, what's cool about it is that it reminds me of like the best, like when I say TurboVision, I don't know if you remember that, but like Object Pascal TurboVision, or like remember Midnight Commander on Linux?
Yeah.
Norton Commander. These are like app, they have like ASCII for their frames. And then in C64S, of course, we're on a podcast, so you can't see this. You've got a certain buttons for the system menu and for the resizing and stuff. And you've got different glyphs. So it's like a really nice command prompt with glyphs for things and handles. And when you're moving things around, the only way that you know you're in a text mode is that it snaps to the columns and rows of the text mode, but it makes it very fast. And it feels very natural. It feels very Commodore-ish. It's like it's the operating system they should have given us 40 years ago. Where were you 40 years ago?
Yeah. Well, that's what I think. Yeah. I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, that's right. But there are similar limitations even if it's bitmapped. So like Geos is bitmapped.
Right.
But the big problem is that it's slow, right? Like bitmapped is slow. Even with bitmapping, you have to do most things in just two colors, because as soon as you introduce colors, the video chip actually has cell-based limitations as to where the colors can go. And so things often have to align to those. Like you can tell that things are snapping to 8x8 pixel cells. But I was just pointing out that even with a bitmap, as long as you use color, you also have to snap things to those 8x8 cells. So yeah. Yeah, so the VIC-2 can also use like a character set that's in RAM. So you just, you know, the character set is in, there's a ROM-based character set, but C64OS uses the character set in RAM. And there's like a whole chunk of, I mean, the character set's kind of divided into 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, kind of 8 blocks. And the top half is the mirror of the bottom half, like the reverse of the top half is the reverse of the bottom half. And so of a half, you get 4 blocks, and one of those 4 blocks is dedicated to graphical user interface stuff. So that's 32 characters. You get 32 characters for numbers and symbols. You get 32 characters for lowercase plus a couple symbols, and you get 32 characters for uppercase plus a couple symbols. And then you have 32 more characters, and they are dedicated for graphical user interface-y type.
Enhancements and things. Yeah. Right. And all of this has enabled you to build not only a lovely modern-looking user interface with movable windows, you've got the file system abstracted, you've got an app launcher, you've got the file manager, like a real file manager that looks familiar to people who have used a windowing environment before. And then a whole series of utilities, like you say, small programs that you can run concurrently alongside your application. So again, if I were going to write an application on my blue prompt unmodified C64, I've got the 6502 available to me and some very basic things available. I could upgrade it to Jiffy DOS. I might get a little bit more available. But if I build it on top of C64 OS, you're a platform, aren't you, that I could build my applications on top of?
That is the idea. Yeah, that's the idea. I haven't I haven't sunk my teeth into writing the programmer's guide yet.
Yeah.
But that's because I've been working so hard on the user's guide and getting version one to the point of being able to make it saleable.
Yeah.
But as soon as it's out, I'm going to turn my attention to, like, as I continue to work on new utilities and stuff, I'm going to also be writing the programmer's guide. And hopefully I'll get feedback from people about what they need as well, because, you know, it's sometimes hard to know exactly what people do and don't know.
Okay. So let's talk about how we would install it and what the minimum requirements are. So I've got a Commodore. I ordered a joystick. It's on the way. Found one on Etsy. I got an Epix joystick. Very excited about that. People can build them. There's lots of folks, a lot of joysticks. It's an Atari 2600 compatible port. So there's many choices for joysticks. And then you do need an SD2 IEC drive. And why is that so important to C64 OS?
I'll make one. I mean, I'm not correcting you, but it's just you. Need is a, what you need is a, what I call a modern storage device. So I divide the storage devices into two categories, legacy and modern.
Okay.
The modern devices start around 1990 and the legacy devices are all from the 80s.
Okay.
So the legacy devices are like the 1541, 1571, and 1581. And they have very low capacity disks and they don't support subdirectories of any kind. It's just, you get one directory on the disk.
Okay.
Starting in 1990 with the CMD hard drive and then that sort of family of devices. And then in the kind of mid to late 90s, the IDE 64. And then in the early 2000s, the SD2 IEC. All those devices are what I consider modern storage devices. They're not all available anymore. That's the problem. So, but C64 OS will run on any, can boot from any of those. It's just that the SD2 IEC is the one that's the most readily available now.
I see.
And they come in a whole bunch of different price points and different form factors. And, so yeah, but the basic idea is just that they, all those modern storage devices support, partitions, subdirectories, plus they have a common DOS extended DOS. With commands and path support, and they're all compatible. All those devices that I mentioned are compatible with each other in terms of their DOS commands.
Okay.
And C64 OS needs one of those because, well, it's like an operating system. I mean, just try to imagine Linux and just say, well, why don't we just make Linux work, but every file has to just be in the root directory?
Yeah.
I mean, it just like, you can't even imagine it, right? It's like, what? How
hierarchy.
Could you mean everything in Etsy and everything in lib and everything in user and everything in bin, just put it all in the root directory? It doesn't make any sense, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hierarchically organized into the kernel is in the kernel directory and the drivers are in the drivers directory. And there's, you know, and applications are installed in a certain directory and they themselves are bundles that contain resources and so on.
Okay. So that makes sense. So thank you for that correction. So if I go to c64os.com/buyer's guide, I go to the storage section, I can see there's internally mountable drives and there's cableless drives. And then there's those IDE 64 drives and other options. So some of them more readily available. But the point you were making is that as long as you have some storage that has the hierarchy, then you're able to run 64 OS. Now you can, I understand, upgrade your C64 with more RAM. You could get the Jiffy DOS kernel that we talked about. You could add a modem and things like that for Wi-Fi to kind of do Wi-Fi and do Z modem at the same time. But it's not required. So if you are listening to this show and you have a C64 in your garage, you're like, this could be great for you. This would be super fun. You just need to figure out that storage solution, correct?
Yeah, I'd say the only hardware requirement is an SD2 IEC. And the cheapest and the only thing you need is basically just go get an SD2 IEC. And they're on eBay and stuff. I mean, they're all over the place.
That's awesome.
And of course, tons of people have bought them already, you know, because I don't know how many have been sold, but there's so many people selling them. And they have been for years. There have to be thousands of them out there.
Oh, I had no trouble finding them. I've only been doing this for a couple of weeks since I, you know, kind of get my rebirth into the Commodore 64 environment. And I've actually got two different ones now, and they both came from Etsy and from, you know, random places. I found another one on eBay. So then I would get the C64 OS on an SD card, And that would get me into your environment. And then, you, like you said, you're working on that now. And we'll buy that at c64os.com directly from you?
Right. Yep.
That's awesome.
The only other thing is, I mean, you can use a joystick, as you say. There's drivers for all kinds of input. There's a driver for light pen, if you have a light pen. There's a driver for the Koala Pad. And there's a driver
for the Koala Pad.
You know, yeah, there's a driver for joystick. And there's drivers for mouse. Mm-hmm. So like original mice are kind of, they're hard to find, you know, you're only going to find them at a trade show or whatever. But there are quite a few, mouse adapters for both for USB mice and for PS2 mice. And I would recommend one of those just because it's a much smoother, you know, it's a proportional input device.
Yeah.
So it's a lot more fun than, you know, but a joystick will work. It's just, you know.
Yeah, I went and I ended up getting a little $16 PS2 to Commodore 1351 mouse adapter. And I happened to have, I went to Goodwill, which is like a local thrift store. And for $2, I found a PS2 mouse. So this is not going to break the bank. It might involve you running around looking for hardware, but there's definitely very inexpensive ways to make this happen. I think it was like $15 for the adapter.
I am still kind of thinking about adding to my site some sort of recommended hardware bundles. Get these three things, you know, and you could do this but you know, whatever. I don't know. I haven't figured that part out yet.
There's even a thing called Mouster, which is a universal USB to retro adapter. So like basically it's a universal HID device. Anything that you plug in that shows up as a USB hardware interface device, it'll turn it into a, what was it called? A DB9? The serial?
Yeah. I just bought a Mouster not that long ago.
Is it good?
I've only really used it with the C64 as a 1351, but it works great.
That's great. And these are the kinds of things that we learn when we go poking around in your buyer's guide. Like there's so many fun options and it's such a fun hobby. As we get ready towards the end here though, I have to ask, with all due respect and all nothing but awe, why would you do this? What are you having fun? Is it just feed your spirit? What makes you stick with it? Because you could have quit at any point, but you're making it happen. Like 1.0 is coming this year.
Well, I mean, my first computer was a VIC-20, and then I got a Commodore 64 when I was really young. And in the 90s, I was on the edge of buying a PC, and I discovered that there were all these third-party computer or Commodore hardware expansions. And I ended up buying a bunch of them, and I just stayed with my Commodore 64 because I have that kind of weird personality that I loved it, and But then eventually, by the time the 2000s rolled around, I ended up switching to a Mac. And then I kind of fell out for a while. Like I got married and had some kids, and I was working full time and I was just using my Mac all the time. And I just thought, well, you know, it's finally come to the end, right? Like my Commodore using days are finally over. But something happened over the course of, I don't know, from around, I'll say 2005 to 2015. Something happened in that 10-year period that just made modern computers feel kind of boring. I don't know. It's just something happened and you couldn't open them anymore. And the operating systems became very controlled. And I don't know. Something just kind of... plus, I kept all my old hardware. And I just found myself one day, I was just daydreaming about all the cool stuff that I could do with my Commodore 64 if I put my newfound kind of professional programming skills that I developed as an adult, if I turned around and said, well, what if, and I couldn't do this when I was a kid, but what if I applied that now to my Commodore 64? And then like you, I just kind of fell down the rabbit hole. Like I just pulled it out and set it up one day. And then I started looking online and I just plunged in and started buying new hardware and reconnecting with people. And I found a bunch of people on Twitter and then as I developed, people became interested. And so that kind of spurred me on because people were following me and people were donating money and people were reading my blog. And so it's just been a lot of fun.
That's great. How close are you to a 1.0? I know you're on 0.9 right now as of the time of this recording.
I am extremely close to a version 1.0. My blog has unfortunately suffered this year. I've only put out one blog post. I was kind of on a thing where I was putting out like one every month or maybe a little bit more than that. But then this year I kind of I realized that if I'm going to ever release this, I need to sort of put my foot to the pedal and finish the last so many things I need for a version one release. Like, I don't want to say that I'm done, but in order to get to the point of a version one, I really had to like do some things that are not always the most glorious things that you want to work on, but you have to put in polish and stuff. So my blog kind of took a hit, but that's because I've been spending a lot of time working on like the user manual and other upgrades to the site. And I announced that it would be available this summer. And I am currently burning gold masters and applying label stickers to SD cards. And I've got manuals have already been ordered and are due to arrive. And I've got a bunch of other supplies for doing like a first run. And I don't know how many I'll sell, but if I sell out of my first run, then I'll get materials for a second run, and I'll just keep see where that goes. But I am on schedule to ship this summer.
That's awesome.
Even though it's close to the end of the summer.
I will be in line. Would you mind telling me what I'm expected to pay for a C64 OS in the year of our Lord 2022?
Well, I hadn't announced a price up to now. Do I have to announce the price? I don't know. I feel like maybe I should put out my website where it actually has marketing blurbs.
We'll put it on the website. I just want to make sure I have my allowance and it doesn't cost more than a Commodore 64 does.
No. So I have kind of two levels. I've got a starter and a standard. And the starter is $59 Canadian, and the standard is $64 Canadian.
Fantastic.
So I thought that was a good number.
I think that's a brilliant idea. Folks can follow and purchase at C64OS. This is really brilliant. It's been lovely chatting with you today, and I appreciate the work that you and the larger C64 community is doing to keep this now 40-plus-year-old device causing enjoyment to us every single day. Thank you so much, Greg Nasu, for chatting with me.
All right. Thank you very much for having me.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.